KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Viva Mike McGinn!
Viva!
Viva Mike McGinn!
With every administration, we hope that we have a more diverse cabinet that again reflects America.
I'm going to make every effort that I can possibly do to identify a potential buyer that would ensure that the Sacramento Kings remain in Sacramento.
That was the mayor of Sacramento, Kevin Johnson, talking about the alleged sale of the Sacramento Kings. Elaine Chao, who served as Secretary of Labor for 8 years in cabinet of President George Bush, talking about the work, and somebody at a Mike McGinn rally shouting out for Mike McGinn, who announced his re-election campaign. Joni Balters is assistant political. Joni Balter is.
I became plural all overnight.
Is assistant
like
political editor for the Seattle Times.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Knut Berger is the Mossback columnist at Crosscut, author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Sir.
Good morning, Steve.
Everybody has to say good morning. It's the class.
Yeah, say good morning.
Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger.
Nice to be here.
And
good morning.
And good morning to you. What if we were very formal the whole time?
I think we're going to try that. Come on,
yes,
let's
sir.
Try it,
yes,
sir.
Yes. Ms. Balter,
yes.
Your reaction to here's a little clip from I'm going to combine the two things here. Here's a little clip from Mike McGinn talking about the Sonics, and you know, it was interesting that Mike McGinn made his announcement for reelection proximate to these rumors flying about a possible return of NBA.
You know, my mom always said you'd rather be lucky than good. So it's been a lot of hard work and in a challenging budget environment to get where we are today. I don't think I entered office thinking that this type of opportunity would present itself, and we have to be really grateful to Chris Hansen for coming forward and be willing to invest so much. So we were just trying to take our opportunities where we saw them to do something good for the city.
All right, so Mike McGinn talking about that. He wasn't, you know, he was not equating that, but here he is getting ready to run. It's a good thing for him.
Well, when you're getting ready to run, what you have to do is compile a list of things that you can refer to as accomplishments. Everybody knows the mayor had a rocky start. He had some rough relations there at the beginning with the council and some members of the business community. So what he wants to do, and the timing was propitious, and that is a $27 word.
It really is.
SAT kind of word. But the timing was nothing he had any control over, and that's why he was referring to the whole lucky thing. You know, not only am I standing here today announcing my reelection, but one of my accomplishments may be coming true. Because, you know, he can't really claim that he's got the whole thing together until he gets a team. But it was, you know, it was just, in some ways, a press person might say, well, you were upstaged by this. In other words, instead of everybody coming to your press conference to find out, oh, my gosh, you might be running for mayor, they were coming to find out if the rumors about the Sacramento Kings coming to Seattle were true. And he did run into that at that press conference.
But when I talked to you folks and you, your colleagues, you ink-stained wretches and your colleagues, Mike McGinn seems to need all the attention he can get from.
Absolutely, when you have that many very strong candidates in the race against you.
Or you need just enough attention to stand out among a crowd of five or however many we end up with in the primary and get yourself through and then make your argument against one person. So the other thing that was interesting about McGinn's announcement was where it was held, down in South Seattle among communities that he did very well with in the last election and that are often not exactly ignored but kind of put on the back or further than back burner by mayoral candidates. And so what he's demonstrating is that he actually has a formidable coalition. He has a constituency that he can point to and perhaps leverage to get him through the primary. And there's questions about what exactly the constituency is for some of these other candidates.
Well, that was a very interesting staging of a press conference as far as I was concerned, because if you remember, before the 2009 primary and immediately right after, the question about Mike McGinn was, had he ever been south of the Ship Canal? And he instantly opened an office down by Othello and began courting, you know, minority voters. But he was, you know, everyone was so surprised when he did so well in the primary, because he was largely regarded as this sort of North End, young urbanist kind of guy who was would essentially be mayor of Greenwood, not of Seattle. So,
although given people's attention spans, that's now kind of ancient history. And I think first of all, he did really well among those communities, like I said, and then second of all, he has a list of things he can point to that have responded directly to those communities' requests over the course of his term, building a community center in South Seattle, for example. And so I don't think he'll suffer from any sense of mayor of Greenwoodness.
Does he have to – actually, do you want to weigh in, or shall I ask this question and then you weigh in?
Well, either. Go ahead. I can weigh in anytime.
Does he what's the population difference north and south of the Ship Canal? I mean, where do most of the people of Seattle live, or is it spread pretty evenly? Don't most people live north?
All your northerners believe that.
I don't know. They must live south because Capitol Hill, First Hill, and the area is much larger.
It is much larger,
and you have,
especially if you want to include
the most densest neighborhoods.
Magnolia.
There. I would imagine that it's, but whether it's south of downtown or not, that's another question. I actually don't know the answer to that.
Difference, of course, is the diversity. You have the most diverse zip code in the nation south of the Ship Canal.
That's been debunked.
98118.
One of the most diverse. Though.
It's one of the most diverse. The Census Bureau doesn't actually collect that
right.
information, so they've
yeah.
been trying to get rid of that 98118 thing, which yeah. is my
but,
actual.
But the political equation is that the South End and Rainier Valley have been important in elections in terms of swinging, especially when you have, like with Nichols and Sidran, or to some degree with McGinn and Malahan, where you have some of the dense neighborhoods and going one way, some of the neighborhoods like Magnolia and North Seattle going another way. And then the battle is sort of the door-to-door battle in turning out minority voters and other voters in the South End. And, your ground operation is very critical there, but also addressing the needs of those communities. McGinn has a case to make for what he's done. He's also done some things that people down there don't like, particularly on the police accountability, which I think is a vulnerability for him there. There are other candidates running who have credibility down there too, Peter Steinbrück and others who've worked on neighborhood issues in the South End and when he was on the council and after. So it'll be, it'll be a battlefield. And I was talking with a McGinn supporter who was very involved in his first campaign. One of the things he was saying I thought was interesting was that there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm among the sort of young urban people for McGinn last time. And that enthusiasm level has really dropped. It's divided maybe among other candidates, or it's not quite there. And he has the advantage of incumbency and the advantage of having some successes and whatnot. But this person who's a McGinn supporter was saying he's really going to have to work. This is going to be to win, he's really going to have to work. He's not going to be able to take any neighborhood or any votes for granted. And I think that's true both in the primary and if he makes it through the primary to the general. And the good news on the McGinn side is he's a really good campaigner. He's a really hard worker and a really dedicated, dogged campaigner. But on the other side, it creates opportunity, which obviously other candidates sense from the polling and whatnot, that he's got some significant vulnerability.
And the vulnerability also shows in the money. So he has a bit of an enthusiasm gap and a little bit of a cash gap if you just look at money raised during December. I think he raised like $8,000 or $9,000, which compared to some of the other candidates was a low number. So this mayor's race is so interesting because there's so many candidates and it's so hard to sort of figure out how it divides. Is it north? Is it south? Is it minorities versus majorities? It's just very hard to figure out how this many candidates divide the 100%.
I was just going to say, McGinn biked up to The Stranger not long ago and did an interview with Dominic Holden, our news editor, where he talked about a lot of these things, and that's in the paper this week. But one of the things that Dominic pointed out in his piece is when you were talking about, you know, enthusiasm gap this year versus last cycle among young people potentially or among his core constituency, Dominic was pointing out that one of the criticisms of McGinn actually is that he has underfunded the Bicycle Master Plan. You heard so much from a number of people about McGinn, you know, loving bikes more than cars, or this fictional war on cars that supposedly existed that he was, you know, leading. And in fact, there's some concern among the bike community about how much he's funded the Bicycle Master Plan. And that's just one among several things that I think starts to chip away at that enthusiasm.
Except I hear people complain about McGinn because he's been too pro-bicycle. Could he use that?
Well,
it's like he can't win on that one,
yeah,
because he's got the bike people saying you were supposed to do all of it, and then he's got the rest of the city saying you're too focused on the bikes.
I'd like to say one thing in his defense on this, just overall, is that Mike McGinn has been mayor through 3 years of a terrible recession.
Fair.
And economic situation. And so he didn't begin with, I mean, he might have gotten elected with a little luck, but he didn't begin in a lucky situation. He had to do a lot of budget cutting. He and the council had to do a lot of budget cutting. They had to trim a lot of things that they liked. It wasn't like the expansionist Nichols years where there was more and more and more money. That situation looks likely to change. It depends on the overall economy, but all you have to do is look at the cranes downtown. A huge chunk of our city's revenue comes from development and taxes related to development, sales taxes and whatnot. So looking ahead, he may be able to do more on things like the Bike Master Plan, or there may be more funding options than were available during this kind of cut.
Well, so the governor had the same story for her term, Governor Gregoire. Del Constantine had the same story in Mike McGinn. But this year, partly because the library levy passed, the city was in better shape than the city, than the county or the state. And, you know, so that started to set the table, shall we say, for a better economic climate,
better
for this city.
Could I make one comment about the Sonics? I think the significance, I don't know whether the Kings deal will go through. I mean, the fact that the old owners have said they wanted some sort of say in the team after they sell it is absurd. And I'm sure Chris Hansen's way too smart to ever go for that. But from a momentum standpoint, if they were able to obtain a franchise before the EIS is completed, it would create, I think, a nearly unstoppable momentum for getting the arena built. The EIS has to look at alternative locations. We do have at least one candidate for mayor, Peter Steinbrück, who seriously thinks that some of those alternative locations might be better than the one in SoDo. That potentially could become the sort of tunnel issue for Peter Steinbrück if he's seen as an obstructionist or whatever on the stadium. And so the process is going forward, but if Hansen is able to get a franchise, I think it would create almost unstoppable momentum for that SoDo site.
Hmm. Can I ask you guys to do something? This is like one of those shows again. But give me a nutshell pro and con for McGinn going into this election now. Why he should win and what his biggest problem
is. I'm probably not in the should business, but I'll tell you his strengths and his weaknesses.
All right,
how's that sound?
Oh, fine.
Just do that. You know, look, his strengths are that he does like to listen to a lot of communities tell him what's bothering them and what they're looking for from their mayor. He's a very good listener. His strengths are that he has settled down, you know, sort of in this he was viewed as very antagonistic when he first came in to a lot of different groups, and he sort of settled down on some of those. I think a lot of people would agree with that. And he does have some accomplishments.
You give me three.
Yo.
You only had to give me one.
Oh, you didn't say. These are worse than the instructions for that test that Garfield is unwilling. I need instructions. Otherwise, I just start going.
Where is he weak? Well, give me one weakness.
Well, the weakness is expressed clearly by the number of strong candidates that think he's weak. These people would not be raising the amounts of money that they are. How much is it for Burgess and how much is it for Ed Murray? You know, over $100,000. They would not be raising that kind of money if...
Well, he was weak politically. But I mean weak in terms of what he's executed as his...
Well, I guess it's some of the baggage from the early years.
I see.
I guess you'd have to mention some of that because he had a rough start. He came out swinging against the tunnel. The vote went against him. And then he had all those relationships to build and rebuild, and also the police issues are part of the narrative of the four-year term, the three-year, by now three-year, but eventually four-year.
You can just give me one of each if you want, Knut.
Oh, on strengths and weaknesses? Well, one strength that goes into the sort of, I think he has a number of strengths, but one of them will be, I think, the improving business climate and the improving economy. I think that's going to help him just by virtue of the fact that he's an incumbent.
That's just his luck. But any strength from
him
personally?
That is a strength. Well, in terms of him personally, I think Mike McGinn, I think the mayor's race is going to be about vision. Who best articulates a vision? Because I think ideologically these people, these candidates are not going to be, they're all liberal Democrats, basically. And so it's what shade are you, and whether you're more of a bike guy or a Sonics guy or what, there's going to be these sort of shadings. I think Mike McGinn has done a very good job of articulating his vision for the city. And people might disagree with the emphasis on bikes or how high the skyscrapers are going to go or whatever. But I think, from the standpoint of Sierra Club urbanist, I think he's done a really good job of defining what kind of city he wants.
Sierra Club urbanist.
I think his strength will be the ability to point to steady leadership in a difficult time and meaningful accomplishments, and that he actually expresses the values of Seattle liberalism incredibly well. He is a very good ideological match for the city. The weakness is that he has been branded and contributing to this branding through his own actions. He's been branded as someone who's intemperate, who can't get along, which, is not a dispositional fit for Seattle. And so if he can counter that, what he and his team would call a caricature and what other people would call a somewhat founded description, but if he can counter that by pointing at his record and really, really making a connection with people on a values level where I think he actually does connect, then maybe he can overcome the fundraising problem, which is huge. He's behind, what is that guy's name? Charlie Studebaker? Did I make that up?
Stedeker. He calls you a Studebaker. That's how that goes.
But by the way, he might like that. All right. McGinn's our guest on Monday, so we'll ask questions and listen in terms of the strengths and weaknesses you guys articulated. We'll take a break. This is Weekday.
It's 29 degrees in Seattle under a mostly clear sky. Forecast says expect it to be sunny today with a high of 39.
Support for KUOW comes from WIM WIM, Seattle's new contemporary dance company led by Olivier Wevers, presenting Crave More, four dance premieres at Seattle Center Playhouse, January 18th to 20th. Tickets and information at wimwim.org.
It's 10:23. I'm Bernard Ouellette. We're going to continue now reflecting on the news of the week, and here's something. Teachers at Seattle's Garfield High School are refusing to administer a standardized test. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld is all over this story. We're going to hear from her in about 10 minutes.
All right. Now let's go back into it, shall we? This news thing. I'm going to leave local for just a moment. Actually,
I was just going to say 31 flavors of liberal Democrats.
Yeah, that was nice. I was thinking of all the different descriptions you could have of the 31 liberal Democrat flavors.
You've got the rocky road. You've got the
bikey road.
Yeah.
Bikey road.
But before we delve into some other stories, I just wanted to remember, and I'm sure you guys knew him. So Shelby Skates was a longtime Seattle PI reporter, columnist. He passed away last week. He covered politics. One time, Shelby Skates and Mike Layton came into the studio together.
Oh, wow.
And that was a lot of memories, a lot of history, a lot of
legislature, right?
A lot of old school journalism.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He covered the civil rights struggle in the South during the presidential campaigns, and he covered 35 years of Seattle politics. So since he passed away, we just wanted to remember him for a minute. He told a story when he was here in December of 2000, and I asked him about covering Jack Kennedy in the civil rights movement.
Kennedy and I had an unusual meeting. He was a senator, and I went to interview him for International News Service, and we got along famously. And he said, well, come with me out to the airport. This was in Dallas, Texas, and the airport was Love Field. So I rode out with him, and I started quizzing him about the race situation. And he told me he didn't want to talk about it, and I kept pushing him on it and pushing him. And finally, he turned around, and he was angry. His veins in his neck were sticking out. And he lost his temper, and he said, if you ask me that one more time, I'll stop this car, and you're going to have to walk back to Dallas. Well, I didn't want to do that. But we got to the airport, and I realized that I had blown a good interview, and I got out of the car and ran toward the cab stand. The guy grabbed me by the shoulder and said, come back and apologize. And his daughter, Caroline, had just been born back there in New York City, or Washington, wherever you live. And his plane was delayed. So we went into the coffee shop in Love Field in Dallas, and we talked for about an hour and a half. And all we talked about was the race issue. And he explained to me how he could not. He knew the situation. I'd covered Little Rock, and he was especially eager to know all about the smallest details and about Little Rock, which I told him. But I kept my mouth shut about that. He realized that something had to be done. And come 1963, before he was shot to death, he did offer the landmark civil rights bill, which reshaped our society. Senator Magnuson and President Johnson passed it, but Jack Kennedy was the author of that bill.
That was Shelby Skates. He wrote War and Politics by Other Means, a journalist's memoir. That's what we were talking to him about back then in 2000. Now, you knew him?
Yeah, I did, and it was great to hear that sort of Tennessee. He was born in Tennessee, that accent. Senator?
Yeah. Sounds like he should have been fighting with Davy Crockett at the Alamo. You know,
something like that.
And you knew him, too?
I did, yeah. And I worked both at The Weekly, but also years ago at Adventure Travel Magazine. Shelby was an outdoorsman and a mountain climber. He wrote for us then and wrote for The Weekly from time to time in his post-daily newspaper years.
Hmm. All right. You didn't know him.
Didn't know. Sounds like someone I would have loved to have a.
You were a younger man. You're a younger man.
I was. I was, and am, I guess. Maybe. Still.
Yeah, you still are. But older.
An older, younger.
Older, younger man. You know, since you mentioned it, and then since this is remembering a journalist who passed away, and I'm not saying this to rub it in, former editor of the Seattle Weekly, but what do you make of the Seattle Weekly being sold to David Black? A newspaper mogul of small and community papers and nickel ads, little nickel ads.
Little nickel, yeah. Well, David Black is one of those media barons who has chosen to invest in newspapers that other people were getting, investments that other people were getting out of, and he's accumulated a chain in U.S., Canada, and other places of mostly community papers. He owns some dailies, and he owns a whole bunch of small newspapers in the Puget Sound area, and he's got his fingers in other investment pies. He's a big figure up in British Columbia, and his company wanted to buy The Weekly back in 1997, and they were actually one of the sort of final bidders.
Suitors.
Suitors.
Is that right?
Yeah. And the board went with a Village Voice instead, Stern Publications. Went in a different direction. My sense was that they did a really good job with some of their community papers, but they're really driven by a financial strategy of consolidating. You know, that's sort of the way he's taken papers that were independent and consolidated them into a chain to get the advantages of scale that you can get. You can buy a printing plant, you can print all your papers there and that kind of thing. So it'll be really interesting. His interests have purchased two alternative papers, SF Weekly in San Francisco.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Seattle Weekly.
Oh,
yeah,
is
well,
that
they're
right?
Different. They're different divisions, but Sound Publishing bought Seattle Weekly, and then another Black-owned outfit bought the SF Weekly. And, it'll be really interesting. I don't think the company is I think they have some alternative papers in Canada, but they're not, you know, sort of steeped in that.
Is that right, that Black owns the San Francisco Examiner? I thought it was the
not the Examiner.
It's the he owns at least part of the Examiner, and Examiner bought SF Weekly, so he's got a finger in the two two pies.
When you look at when you just look here in the States, so Arlington Times, Auburn Reporter, Bainbridge Island Review, Bellevue Reporter, Bellingham Business Journal. I mean, they've got a lot ringing the city. So this is his sort of first.
Yeah,
footprint so maybe, in the city, right?
Yeah, and there you see part of the rationale for doing this. As I understand it, and I'm just learning about this man and his properties, but, you know, a lot of what he does is advertising inserts, you know, coupons. And so if you're doing that at a large scale and you have a big hole in Seattle, maybe you want a paper that you can put more inserts into.
But I couldn't help but wonder whether or not he'll do some of the cross-usage of the material, the content in these different publications that, you know, actually people are interested in, Bainbridge Island and Bellevue and the rest of it, to maybe be part of the content.
What I'm really interested in is the cultural mesh, if there is one. I mean, this is not typically how great alt-weeklies begin or continue. They're founded by people who really believe in alternative journalism, who need a space for something that can't be expressed elsewhere and so create that space for themselves, or want to get into that space so buy into it. This doesn't seem like that kind of motivation. And so actually I'm curious what Knut you think, because you spend a lot of time at the Seattle Weekly and it sounds like you know Black's papers as well, about the cultural fit or lack of fit here. Because I think for the average media consumer in the city, that and the outcome of that will be the most interesting and consequential aspect of this.
Yeah, and I really can't speak to it because I don't know what their plans are. I would say that that given the types of papers they've been involved in, I'm concerned about that. I hope it'll have a rejuvenating effect. I hope that. But, you know, it's just really hard to.
Well, they don't have a lot of reporters on the staffs of these other papers.
No. And
the weekly's
cut way
back as well.
Yeah, but that's where the cross-pollination might come in, you know, because that's a way of doing it.
But
share.
I will point out that the weekly doing what it does now, and I think the Black papers are, you know, doing more and more on the web as well. Mm-hmm. But the weekly has been stripped down in terms of its editorial staff and whatnot. Not just the size of the paper, but in terms of staffing, to almost a sound publishing scale thing already. I mean, it's been significantly. This is not the newspaper that was published in the 1980s, the 1990s, the early aughts. You know, this is a paper that and that was New Times or Village Voice Media / New Times, which was a devoted alt weekly publishing company, and they have cut and cut and cut costs there already.
Well, one thing I haven't read, and maybe you folks have read it, is why did they want to sell the weekly? Was it losing money? Was it an issue of backpages.com and that sort of
thing? Well, that may have been their financial plan, and then now it's not such a good plan, so maybe that made it ripe for sale.
Well, my guess is it connects to all of those things that you were saying. The Village Voice Media Empire, of course, owns the Village Voice, the LA Weekly, a lot of properties around the country. There was huge controversy over Backpage, which was its holding that, you know, an online-only kind of Craigslist-like space where they were allowing, they were being criticized for having a lot of escort ads and underage escort ads and all kinds of things they shouldn't have. And they eventually got so much heat for this that they spun Backpage off of VVM. They made a separate company and sold VVM to basically
managers.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to say under editors, but managers is the better way to put it. And so suddenly a whole different group of people owned all of these papers and I think probably needed to get rid of a few of the really money-losing ones, of which the Weekly probably was one of them. And so Black then can snatch it up at a very cheap price.
Right, that's right.
They were requiring IDs when people would place those ads at Backpage, right? In-person IDs.
Yeah, the interesting thing was the Weekly had relatively few of those ads. It was kind of hurt less by giving them up and giving up they gave up escort ads also. They could have got rid of the entire category at the Weekly. And I think the We don't know what the terms of the VVM purchase was, but this appears to be connected to the new management's financing or way of having to manage the company going forward. And I think both Seattle Weekly and SF Weekly. SF Weekly was also hurt not by Backpage, but by a long, big lawsuit that they lost against the Bay Guardian.
Oh, that's right.
And yeah. required a large. There was a large judgment against them.
Well, we'll see what the world is like with the Weekly being run that way, and what kind of journalism comes from that. Teachers at Seattle's Garfield High School are refusing to give students a standardized test that's called the MAP, calling it a waste of time and money. So Ann Dornfield is going to give us a little more on that. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Steve.
How's Since you are the education reporter here at Indeed. This station, what is MAP and why does Garfield use it at all?
Well, Seattle Public Schools students take a lot of state standardized tests, but the MAP is only required by the Seattle School District. It's an adaptive computerized test, and it's supposed to test the limits of kids' knowledge in reading and math, so it gives them progressively harder questions on those subjects. And all students in Seattle Public Schools take the MAP two or three times a year from kindergarten through ninth grade, and students in special ed or kids who are learning English take it through 12th grade. The district says the MAP is given that often so that teachers can track how well kids are learning throughout the school year. But one of teachers' criticisms at Garfield is that they don't know what's on the test. They say that it's not aligned to their curricula. So a student who's in Algebra 1 might be getting geometry, probability, statistics questions. And that doesn't make students feel that great to not know what's on the test, to not know the anything about the questions on the test. And teachers say that they're not even allowed to look at the test after it's administered, so they're pretty clueless about the content, so they can't prepare students for it. And the teachers say that all they get after the test is a score for each student and no indication of what was measured or how to interpret that score.
Well, how does Garfield use it?
Well,
or how does the school district use these tests?
One of the things they do is they use it in teacher evaluations. It's one of the factors that is calculated for teacher evaluations, and teachers are not happy with that.
Is that the crux there?
I don't think that that is the crux. I think that they don't see it as a good use of classroom resources, time, or money, but they also don't care for the fact that it's used in their evaluations, and they have no way to prepare for it.
How much time, how much money?
Well, the reading and math tests are supposed to take each student an hour and a half several times a year, but the teachers say that the test also ties up computer lab time, and often computer labs are in libraries, so that ties the library up while testing's underway. And they say that that's especially hard on kids who need that computer lab time doing research projects or kids who don't have computers at home. And on those ELL kids and kids in special ed, because those kids need to take the most MAP tests, and they are the ones teachers say need the most time in the classroom.
I'll just say, as a longtime Garfield parent, that we welcomed, if that's the right word, maybe not, different sort of flavor of the month tests that would come in. There was the Wassel when my kids were there. Students would get so apoplectic about some of these tests. So much time went to it. I believe, though, the Wassel, which was a statewide requirement, which has been watered down a bit, but I believe at least that the teachers could try to prepare. They knew what the goals were. They knew what the standards were. And you can understand if a teacher is going to be evaluated on something like this, they at least want to know what they're up against. But, and more importantly, the students want to know what they're up against, because quite a bit of anxiety for these students goes into these tests, because they know teachers form opinions of them based on the results, but they don't know what to study for. That's challenging, for a kid.
As a former Garfield student, I like the activism that's being expressed here. I mean, you have something very unusual going on. All teachers at one public school unanimously defying not only the state, but their own school board. The school board, I think, put out a press release this morning saying, we expect teachers to administer this test. So there's this really interesting clash that's shaping up. And Steve, you shared that comment from, I guess, a
Facebook,
listener.
Yeah, from listener Facebook, yeah.
Who was saying, you don't see this happening at schools in where the population is more entirely disadvantaged. There's something about Garfield being home to the, is it still called APP? What's it called now? The APP program? APP?
Yeah, they still have
that. That allows them to kind of a certain immunity to fight fight or fight against things that are hurting all students, not just the APP students. And so this is a school where you'll see students walk out against, you know, the war, walk out against other things. And this is, I think, a continuing expression of the activism that you'll see at Garfield.
As a classmate of Eli's at Garfield, it was great to be back at Garfield yesterday and to talk to kids there. The student government voted to support the teachers, as Eli was referring to. And I also caught up with a student in the hallway who said that she is proud of the teachers for, in her words, fighting for what's right. So here's 16-year-old Garfield Jr. Alicia Butler.
I feel like it's kind of a waste of time to take. It takes up class time. It doesn't. Some things are on there that we don't learn. And it's not fair to the teachers because they're being evaluated. And since people are aware that we don't need to graduate, they'll just start clicking on things. A lot of these teachers here are good, so they'll get lower evaluations, and it's not fair.
Is this going to become something more than about the MAP test?
It already has, Steve. This rebellion by Garfield teachers, I think, is really capturing the attention of teachers and parents and education policy activists around the country. And there's been such a national education reform movement that's emphasizing high-stakes standardized tests like this and as a means of accountability. But the well-known testing critic and education historian and author Diane Ravitch told me that this is the first time she's aware of that an entire school of teachers has voted to boycott a test.
You know, that press release from the Seattle School Board. Seattle Public Schools expects our teachers to administer all required tests pursuant to our policies and procedures. Last fall, during an annual report to the board on November 28th, it was agreed that the district would review the effectiveness of MAP testing. We look forward to hearing from our principals and teachers as part of that process. Report is expected to be presented in the spring. Not moving fast enough for the teachers, huh?
No, and you know what? This test has been scrutinized from the beginning because it turned out that the former superintendent Maria Goodloe Johnson sat on the board of the testing company at the time the contract was approved.
Uh-oh.
And the state auditor later called that a violation of the district's ethics policy, although the district's own investigation disagreed with that. But this is a $500,000 annual contract that the district has been renewing with the testing company. So it'll be interesting.
Is there – so you saw those – text that those Facebook posts that went out, and one was from a teacher. And he was asking the question, do you mean the measure of academic progress or the measure of student progress tests? The former is in-house, not reported by the state. The latter is the state test. Have you heard anybody saying this MAP controversy slips over into the question about the measure of student progress tests, which is that the one that replaced the WASL? Is that the watered-down WASL?
Right. And the Garfield teachers say that they're not calling out other tests, that they just think that the MAP really does not tell them anything about what students are learning, so there's no justification for it. Although, you know, standardized testing overall is it's a hot topic with teachers and with parents and with students. I think that this is a wider issue, definitely.
And no other school has taken it up?
Not so far.
North High School's taking it up.
And is the test that they're protesting at Garfield a state-required test or just...
No, this is only a district-required test. Right, okay. Yeah.
Right, because we have other tests for that. All right.
Tests galore.
Welcome to Seattle, Mr. Banda.
That's right. Has he said anything yet?
I'm looking forward to talking with him today.
All right. Ann Dornfeld is the KUW Education Reporter. We'll hear that story later. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break. This is Weekday.
It's 30 degrees in Seattle, and the sky is mostly clear. It's going to be sunny today with a predicted high of 39. Overnight, partly cloudy, a low of 28. Tomorrow, Saturday, partly sunny, chance of flurries in the afternoon, and a high of 38. In the year 2011, nearly half of inmates in federal prison were serving time for drug offenses. That's according to the U.S. Department of Justice. Now, as you know, Washington State recently legalized marijuana. But what about heroin, crack, and meth? Some folks think we should legalize those as well. What do you think? Should we legalize all drugs? Why or why not? We're going to be talking about that this afternoon at 12:20, and we'd love to get your thoughts right now. Give us a call, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. We're contemplating the legalization of all drugs this afternoon at 12:20 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW thanks the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:45. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is in the other Washington today meeting with President Obama. We're following that and we'll have an update in our top of the hour newscast, which is just about 15 minutes away.
We will wrap up this hour of reviewing the news with Knute Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders with a couple of topics. One, just a quick one, the criticism of President Obama. For you heard Elaine Chao at the beginning of the show criticizing the president for his lack of diversity in his cabinet nominees. What do you think?
That was quite a photo that was in the New York Times, and it had his cabinet, and they were all gathered around wearing their male suits, ties.
And even the ladies.
What? And there was a leg sticking out that you really had to look carefully to see belonged to an actual woman. So the cabinet is pretty heavy male. It could use a little other kinds of diversity, but I have this feeling, I mean, I don't know for sure, but that, and Obama, you know, the recent appointments have all been white guys. Anybody else notice that? Yeah. So
the Republican Party noticed it.
We'll see if he doesn't counter back with, some announcement that shakes that, because he's very sensitive to that.
You could probably talk about all those judges that haven't been put into position. Yeah.
Well, we'll see if he counters back.
I noticed that story went up on the New York Times Online yesterday. At least that's when I saw it. And then I clicked over to the Seattle Times just to catch up on what we were going to be talking about this week. And I saw a story saying that Gregoire had left for D.C. For interviews on a possible cabinet post. So he's, you know, at the same time.
Oh, she said she was going for something completely different.
And there were no official meetings were scheduled.
No official meetings. The only thing that was interesting about that was she was in and out of D.C. really quick. So I wondered how much time she had.
Well, the Washington Post said she's being considered for the head of EPA.
Yeah.
And so for her, I don't know, you know, what exactly the motivation for bringing her out there is, but you know, there's some concordance where at the same time that Obama is being criticized for having no women in his cabinet so far, he's potentially was having a sit down with Gregoire about the EPA.
In terms of Olympia right now, speaking of Gregoire, what do you see shaping up in terms of Jay Inslee and the people he's chosen and his relationship to whoever the leadership is going to be in the legislature?
Right. Well, we'll see how that plays out. Dominic and David Goldstein, were down in Olympia yesterday, the day before, talking to the new leadership and also talking to Inslee. And one of the questions that Inslee got asked was, are you standing by your pledge not to raise taxes? And he gave a slightly dodgy answer, and then his spokesperson gave a non-dodgy answer that was yes. But I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into this, but maybe we're seeing Inslee bumping up against the reality expressed by Gregoire herself that you can't solve the state's budget problems without some new revenue. And so he may be trying to find a creative way out of it that, you know, we're going to see him come forward with his budget, he's promised, pretty soon. The other thing that I just want to say very quickly is that the legislators, at least you see this as a strategy from Rodney Tom and the Republicans, they're kind of playing the McCleary imperative off against the social services imperative and basically saying you have to pick one. We are either going to fully fund education or we're going to fund social services, but we can't do both. And the both and solution, of course, is to raise revenue. But we could have a third way forward if the Supreme Court, which dropped the McCleary decision on the legislature, would come forward with its decision about whether you need a two-thirds majority, in fact, to raise taxes.
Would they were that clear about actually expressing that was the choice that was being offered, right, between social services and education? Because when you try to pin them down, I find them very dodgy on that.
The legislature?
Yeah.
It actually seemed, well, I don't know. The interpretation, I think, is very clear. No matter what they're saying, I think that's where they're going with it.
Well, one of the biggest dynamics in Olympia, of course, is this this bipartisan coalition, which has been created by two Democrats joining with Republicans, and then a sort of battle royale as to who will chair different committees. At first, it seemed as if Republicans would chair the key committees and Democrats were offered lesser committees. And Ed Murray, who was supposed to be the Senate Majority Leader, but Rodney Tom changed that with this move, said he'd rather be like a legitimate minority rather than in this sort of strange hybrid that he didn't seem like he knew how it would work. But yesterday, the Tacoma paper reported that some Democrats are saying individually that they would like to chair some of those committees. And so it may end up looking more. And so whatever this, the Senate's going to be where the action is, and it's going to be this odd thing to watch because this is a very unusual arrangement, and we'll see how successful it is. You also have in the midst of this State Senator Pam Roach, who cannot avoid newspaper headlines. It's just her thing. And she's part of the Rodney Tom in gaining this had to secure Pam Roach because the votes are so close. And to do that, he lifted some sanctions that had been against her and said, I won't worry about that. I need your vote. And but Pam continues to be Pam. And so, holy smokes. Olympia's fun to watch.
Another issue that we'll be watching in Olympia is gun control. And there's such a stark contrast right now between what is going on in D.C., where you have some movement on gun control with the commission that Biden is leading, and in the state of New York, where their legislature is about to pass some meaningful gun control measures, at some reform of, their gun show loophole and so on. Such a stark contrast between that and what's now possible in the Washington state legislature because of this coup. So Rodney Tom, who once upon a time supported closing the gun show loophole and an assault weapons ban, I believe, as well, has installed in the leadership of the relevant committee on this issue in the Senate a Republican who has an A-plus rating from the NRA. Nothing is going to happen in the state legislature on gun control because of that. And that, I'm sorry, I'm not sorry. That's Rodney Tom's fault. I mean, it's very, very clearly an obstacle that he's created.
And well, did you see who's going to carry the bill in the legislature? Who's going to sponsor it? The first person committed is State Senator Ed Murray. And I had an email exchange with him yesterday where he said, I think he was sort of joking about this part of it. He said, I like bills that take years to pass.
And Rodney Tom is going to be the majority leader?
Yes, Senate Majority
Leader. Senate Majority Leader? Yeah. He is, right?
Yes, under this arrangement, unless somebody goes rogue.
He went rogue to get himself a new job.
Out of rogue. Yeah, well, you've got essentially a kind of center-right coalition. And the struggle will be whether to implement state budget cutting that follows the Rob McKenna strategy or whether they can have something that's a little more sane than that. I think Rodney Tom, it's interesting that we're hearing more now, and it's interesting to hear some of the things that he said, which I don't think help him. One is picking a fight with Seattle. I don't see why he would do that. He said in remarks this week over on the east side that one of the reasons that he did what he did was he thought Seattle had too much influence in the legislature and thought that he would bring balance to represent more of the state. Well, one, that's not his job. Two, as Ed Murray pointed out, Rodney Tom comes from a zip code that's, has household incomes 3 to 5 times larger than the average Seattle income. Medina is one of the richest pieces of real estate in the state. So how he can cast himself as, some kind of populist stretches the imagination. I think that he's made a mistake, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I think he's very determined on the budget to make the cuts, to fund education, to find a path forward there, and thinks that doing that with this coalition is going to be the best way to do that. But I think he's really made a mistake in thinking that the legislature is only about the budget. I mean, that's a huge piece, but it's about guns. It's about abortion. It's about all kinds of other issues Not because the legislature necessarily wants that, because that's life. You know, that's what politics is about, all that stuff. And I think Eli really, you know, put his finger on it, is that he is going to have to be held answerable to what happens in the Senate for issues that he doesn't necessarily want to come forward and be a hot button. He doesn't want to be distracted from education and the budget, but he's going to be, and anybody would be. And I think so it'll be interesting to see whether or not his sort of, you know, focus on that, how that's going to play out in this coalition.
He's also going to have to answer to his district. And we've been talking about this here for the last couple of weeks, whether what Rodney Tom is doing actually represents the people in his district. And there have been a lot of ways to slice that. But I think you saw a pretty definitive answer the other night, where there was a meeting in his district and a Democratic organization in his district said, you know, you have betrayed us, basically, and you will no longer get our endorsement because of what you've done. You need to either change course and start appointing Democrats to these chairmanships, or we don't consider you a Democrat anymore, and you've lost our support. And so you start to see the ground falling out from under Rodney Tom in his own district, and that is going to be that's going to be another reality that he'll have to deal with, in addition to the complicated political reality.
Well, he was a Republican.
He was a Republican until 2006. He switched parties. And then last year he was part of the budget coup, and now he's got this arrangement. So he may be just one of those people who doesn't fit in a party, if anyone's thought of that. A couple thoughts here. The whole Seattle versus Bellevue, Seattle versus the rest of the state. That's a long time political narrative that has been used many a different time in Washington state political history. Slade Gorton did that in 2000, if you remember, in that race. One thought about what you were saying about Rodney Tom and his where he's from. He is from Medina, but if you looked very deep, and Jim Bruner of the Seattle Times tweeted this yesterday, if you look very deep into the description of the government that he's talking about, it says Rodney Tom de Bellevue. He sort of prefers that to Medina, and his argument is that he represents, you know, a lot of Bellevue. But generally speaking, I mean, our style is where you're from, where you live. So that's another thought about it. As to the point about will social issues play, this was really interesting yesterday, a small blog that we had. Democrat Steve Hobbs, Republican Steve Litzow have agreed that they want to bring up that bill, the Reproductive Parity Act, that got stuck in the middle of the budget coup, if everybody remembers that. Steve Litzow got blamed for that, but it was more a political maneuver to keep the budget going rather than his position on that particular issue. And so I think maybe this is just his way of saying, I really do want to express my actual opinion on that and go forward. And so even though the whole thing was, let's not do social issues, let's stay focused on the budget, these two announced yesterday that they were going to push ahead with the Reproductive Parity Act.
All right. Yeah. Well, it'd be an interesting session. Just real quick before we end, you wrote your Heritage Turkey Awards. And,
yeah.
And reading it, I thought, boy, if anybody wanted to see what Paul Theory did in this town, they better go fast.
You better hurry. Yeah. Well, Paul Theory is the father of Northwest modernism. He had a long career, very prolific, built a lot of very famous structures, the Coliseum among them. But just about every year, a major Paul Theory structure is demolished. This year, it was Paul Theory's office. The office where he planned the World's Fair and most of his famous post-war projects. And of course, the Coliseum is now kind of under threat because of the arena taking basketball completely out of there at some point.
Now, you should read more of the – you can find Skip's article at Crosscut and Eli's work, Strange and Slog, and Joni Balter's work at the Seattle Times, the politics blog. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend.
And to you, too.
You, too, Steve.
You, too.
And you folks have an excellent weekend as well. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer, produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Saadi, with help from Molly Williams, Daniel Anthony Goodwin, Alexandra Garrettin. This is Weekday.
Your PC may be under threat. The situation is so serious that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is speaking out on the problem and has some advice on what you should do to protect yourself. What you need to know in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Mini Medical School, a 6-week lecture series designed to educate the public about medical education, research, and clinical care at UW Medicine. Sessions start February 5th and are open to the public. Registration at uwmedicine.org/minimed.
Everybody in Washington is arguing about the trillion-dollar coin, a far-out economic idea that actually began as a comment on a blog post. If internet comments are now driving our debate, does this mean next week's Sunday panel shows will be about whether Taylor Swift is hot? I'm Peter Sagal. Be the first to join us for Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.